Just give me a second,
Geoffrey said, wheezing. Fletcher felt a growing respect for Geoffrey. He had never felt particularly patriotic, with Pelt being so far removed from any major cities, but he admired it in others. I didn't see Scipio's demon. What kind does he have? Fletcher asked, making conversation as Geoffrey began to breathe more easily.
He doesn't. He used to have a felid, but it died before he retired. They say it broke his heart when he lost it. Now he just teaches and manages the citadel,
Geoffrey said. Fletcher wondered what a felid might be. Some sort of cat, perhaps? They walked on past dimly lit corridors to the very corner of the castle, where another staircase spiraled upwards. Geoffrey eyed it with apprehension.
Don't worry, I can manage from here. Just tell me where I need to go, Fletcher volunteered.
Thank God.
You can't miss it. The commoners' quarters are at the very top of the southeast tower.
I'll send someone up for your laundry later.
For now, there's a spare uniform in every bedroom upstairs. Try a couple on and see which of them fits.
You don't want to be known as the smelly one on your first day,
Geoffrey said, already hurrying away. Fletcher resisted the temptation to shout the question that had come unbidden to his mind.
Why did the commoners have separate quarters?
He shrugged it away and began his long journey up the stairs, knowing from what he had seen outside that it was quite a way. At intervals off the staircase, there were wide, round chambers, each one filled with old desks, chairs, and benches, amongst other bric-a-brac. The wind whistled through the arrow slits in the walls, chilling Fletcher to the bone and causing him to put his hood up once again. He hoped it would be warmer upstairs. As he rounded what felt like the thousandth step, he heard a boy's voice above him.
Hang on, that's one of the servants. I think they're going to call us for breakfast.
The boy's voice reminded him of Pelt, the accent common, and hinting at a rural upbringing.
I'm starving. I hope they don't make us sit in silence, like last time.
A girl's voice followed.
Nah, it's only because crusty old Scipio was there that they wanted us quiet. But he complained about the cold so much, I doubt he'll break his fast in the canteen again,
the boy replied. Fletcher rounded the corner into a large room and almost ran straight into a boy with bright blonde hair and the ruddy complexion of a northerner.
Whoops! Sorry, mate. Guess I spoke too soon.
Here, let me help with your bags,
the boy said, pulling at Fletcher's satchel. Fletcher unstrapped it and let him carry it to a long table that sat in the middle of the room.
Rory Cooper, at your service,
the boy said, shaking Fletcher's hand.
Welcome to our humble abode.
It was a round chamber with a high ceiling and two large doors on either side of the back wall. Paintings of battle mages and their demons lined the walls, the faces stern and disapproving. Fletcher grimaced as the draft from the arrow slits blew across the room. A fetching-looking girl with bright green eyes smiled at him through a mass of freckles and wild ginger hair. A blue, beetle-like demon flickered its wings on the table in front of her. Another of them, with an iridescent green carapace, hovered beside Rory's head, filling the room with a soft hum. The demons were larger than any insect Fletcher had ever seen, so large that they would barely fit on a hand. They sported fierce-looking pincers with an armored shell that shone like burnished metal. Fletcher's demon stirred under his hood at their presence, but was not interested enough to come out of hiding.
My name's Genevieve Leatherby. What's your name?
The girl inquired, flashing him a welcoming smile.
Fletcher, it's nice to meet you. Is it just the two of you? I thought there would be more of us commoners,
Fletcher said, hesitating at the name.
There's some more of us downstairs, waiting in the breakfast hall, and the second years eat later than we do, so they are still sleeping. We decided to wait till the servants come and announce it, as the time they serve breakfast hasn't been very consistent so far,
Genevieve said wistfully. I thought there would be more students, too, when I got here,
But there's only 5 of us first years, including you. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. The lack of summoners is the main reason they let women join the army all those years ago.
Rory interjected.
There's 7, if you count the other 2. We heard them last night, but they haven't come out of their rooms yet. Don't know what a laugh they're missing, he said with a wide grin. They'll come round. Everyone loves me eventually.
Come off it. You're an annoying little prig, if ever I've seen one,
Genevieve teased, pushing him playfully. Rory gave Fletcher a cheeky wink and pointed at the furthest door.
Why don't you introduce yourself? Maybe see if they can join us for breakfast.
18. Fletcher pushed the door open to find a short corridor with a row of doors on either side. The door slammed shut behind him as a draft came gusting in from a loophole at the very end of the passageway. He frowned at the sight of it. It was going to be a long, cold winter if this kept up. He heard movement from the nearest room and knocked, hoping he was not waking them. The door opened at his touch. Perhaps the wind had blown it ajar.
Hello?
He asked, pushing it open. Suddenly he was on his back, slavering teeth snapping at him as a heavy weight held him down. He managed to grip the creature by its throat, but it took all his strength to keep the fangs from closing on his neck. As saliva dripped onto his face, Fletcher's imp clawed across the monster's muzzle with a screech. But all that did was cause the creature to yawp in pain with each gnash of its teeth.
Down, Sariel. He has learned his lesson,
came a lilting voice from above. Immediately, the creature stopped its attack and sat back on Fletcher's chest. Still helpless, Fletcher gazed up at it, seeing a canid almost as large as Saccharissa, the size of a small pony. Yet where Saccharissa had wiry black fur, this demon's hair was as blonde and curling as a Corsolum lady's ringlet. Its snout was longer and more refined, with a wet black nose that sniffed at him.
Get it off me!
Fletcher managed to gasp through gritted teeth. It felt like a tree had fallen on him and was crushing his chest. The creature stepped off and sat panting behind the door, its four malevolent eyes still fixed on Fletcher's face.
I shall be writing to the clan chieftains about this. Put with the commoners in a room smaller and less comfortable than a jail cell, which of course is broken into by a young ruffian on the first morning. I had thought, when they gave me Sariel, that they were taking our peace talks seriously. Now I know I was mistaken,
the voice railed, full of bitterness and anger. Fletcher sat up and looked at the speaker, dazed as the blood rushed back to his head. His eyes widened as he saw long diamond-shaped ears that cut through silvery hair. A delicate face looked at him through large eyes that were the color of a clear blue sky. They were filled with distrust and almost looked on the verge of tears. Fletcher was talking to a pale, elfish girl dressed in a lacy nightgown. He averted his eyes and turned away, speaking up in his defense.
Steady on. I was only trying to say hello. I didn't mean to frighten you. Frighten me? I'm not frightened. I'm angry. Didn't anyone tell you that these are the girls' quarters? You're not allowed in here!
The elf screeched like a banshee and slammed the door in Fletcher's face. He cursed at his stupidity.
You moron, he muttered to himself.
That didn't sound like it went very well, Rory said from behind him, a sympathetic look on his face as he poked his head through the common room door.
Fletcher felt a fool.
Why didn't you tell me these were the girls' quarters?
Fletcher snapped, his face reddening as he stormed back into the main chamber.
I didn't know, honest. I guess it makes sense, though, now that I think about it, with Genevieve in this bit, and there being a spare room next door.
Rory trailed behind him.
It's fine. Just make sure you smarten up before teaching starts, or you'll embarrass us in front of the nobles,
Fletcher said, then regretted it. Rory's cheerful expression faded, and Fletcher took a deep breath.
I'm sorry. You're not to blame. It's not every day you get a canid trying to tear your throat out.
He forced a smile and patted Rory on the back.
You were saying something about a spare room?
Sure. Since you're the last here, all the best rooms have gone. I had a look when I moved in. It's not great.
They walked into an almost identical corridor, except for an extra door that had been built at the very end. It looked like an afterthought, more a glorified broom cupboard than anything else. But the inside was more spacious than Fletcher had hoped for, with a comfortable-looking bed, a large wardrobe, and a small writing desk. He grimaced at the open loophole in the wall. He was going to have to stuff it later. There was a uniform folded up on the end of the bed, a navy-colored double-breasted jacket with matching trousers. Fletcher shook it out and groaned. It was threadbare and torn, the brass buttons hanging so loosely that one dangled an inch beneath where it was supposed to be.
Don't worry. I'll take a look at it for you after breakfast. My mother was a seamstress,
Genevieve said from the doorway.
Thanks, Fletcher said, though he wasn't sure how salvageable it was. So, what was she like?
Genevieve asked, her eyes flashing with curiosity.
Is she a southerner, like me?
She's... I'm not sure exactly, Fletcher said, avoiding the question. Now that he had ruined the girl's morning, he didn't want to start gossiping about her as well. Best to let her present herself to the others in her own way. His mind was still reeling from the presence of an elf in the citadel.
Weren't they the enemy?
His thoughts were interrupted by the emergence of the imp, who tumbled from his hood to inspect their new abode. The little demon brushed a uniform onto the floor with a flick of its tail, then hummed with content as it rolled onto its back and scratched itself against the rough fabric. Rory's eyes widened at the sight, and Fletcher smiled to himself.
What's a canid?
Rory pondered aloud as they walked back into the main chamber. They were soon followed by the imp, who clambered onto Fletcher's shoulder and surveyed their surroundings with a protective glare.
You'll find out soon enough. They aren't easy to describe. If your mites are beetle demons, then I would say a canid is a dog demon, if that makes sense.
Fletcher replied proudly, glad to finally know more about summoning than someone else.
Are demons are called mites?
Genevieve asked, holding out a palm and letting her blue beetle settle on her hand.
I'm not sure. I heard the provost use the word, Fletcher replied, sitting down at the table. Oh, well, I just call mine Malachi, like malachite. You know, because of his colouring,
Rory said, letting the green beetle scuttle up his arm.
Mine is called Azura,
Genevieve declared, holding the demon to one of the torchlights so that Fletcher could see the cerulean blue of the creature's carapace. Fletcher paused, feeling awkward as they looked at him expectantly.
What's yours called?
Rory prompted, as if Fletcher was slow.
I haven't really had a chance to name him yet, Fletcher muttered with embarrassment. I know he is a salamander demon, though. Maybe you can help me think up a name over breakfast. Of course. He's got a lovely color to him. I'm sure we can think of something,
Rory exclaimed.
Could we stay away from colors?
Fletcher said, hoping to come up with something more original.
He's a fire demon. Maybe we can use that.
As Rory began to answer, a stern-looking matron walked into the room with a heavy basket of sheets and linens.
Be off with you! I need to clean. You can wait downstairs with the others instead of getting into mischief up here,
she scolded, shooing them down the stairs.
Shouldn't we tell the other two?
Genevieve said, looking back up as they tramped down the winding staircase.
No,
Fletcher blurted, hoping to avoid the elf for at least another few minutes.
The matron will let them know when she gets to their rooms.
They shrugged and led him the long way down the corridor, making suggestions for names. Fletcher's imp went back to sleep with a yawn, oblivious to the debate. Fletcher was starting to wonder whether he was allowing the demon to be lazy, as he watched Malachi and Azura zipping around their owners' heads. They eventually reached the ground floor, and Fletcher was led through the atrium, mouthing an apology at Jeffrey, who was still polishing the floor they were treading on. The boy rolled his eyes with a sad smile and went back to his work. They walked through the set of large double doors opposite the main entrance across the atrium. This room's ceiling was substantially lower, yet it was still a huge space that echoed with their footsteps. Large unlit chandeliers hung at intervals above three rows of long stone tables and benches. The center of the room was dominated by a statue of a bearded man dressed in elaborate armor, carved with startling attention to detail. Fletcher was surprised to find only two boys sitting there, spooning porridge into their mouths with gusto. One had black hair and olive skin. He must have been from a village on the border of the Akkad Desert in eastern Hominum. He was handsome, with a chiseled jaw and lively eyes that were hooded with long lashes. The other boy was chubby, with closely cropped brown hair and a hearty red face. Both waved at him as a servant handed him a tray of porridge, jam, and warm bread. When he sat, they immediately introduced themselves. The fatter boy was called Atlas, and the other, Seraph.
"Is it just you two? Where are the second years?" Fletcher asked, confused.
"We eat before they do, thank heavens!"
Atlas mumbled, abandoning his spoon to slurp the porridge up from the edge of the bowl.
"They need their extra sleep, what with the stress of their more practical lessons,"
Seraph explained, looking at Atlas with a bemused expression.
"They even have field trips to the frontier once a week. I can't wait to be in their shoes." "Wait until you've been there,"
Genevieve muttered, a hint of sadness in her voice. Fletcher noticed and changed the subject. He knew enough about the front lines to sense that she might have lost someone close to her. Perhaps she was an orphan like him.
"Where are your demons? Have you got mites like the others?"
Fletcher was desperate to see more demons.
"No, none yet,"
Atlas said with a hint of jealousy.
"We're still waiting. They said the teachers would be giving us ours tomorrow. They only had two demons on the day we all arrived."
"It was the smart move," Seraph said, half to himself.
"They asked me if I wanted to take one of the mites or wait. I did my homework, asked some of the servants. Mites are the weakest. It's better to wait for the chance of a bigger prize."
Fletcher was intrigued by the mention of better demons. He tried to remember what he had glimpsed in the paintings and carvings around the castle. If only Jeffrey hadn't been in such a hurry. Still, there would be plenty of time for that later.
"I wouldn't have it any other way," Rory replied, defensive. "I wouldn't trade Malachi for anything."
Seraph held his hands up in surrender.
"I meant no offense. I am sure I will feel the same way about my demon when I eventually receive it, might or no might."
Rory grunted and went back to his meal.
"What other kinds of demons do you know of? I've only heard of four,"
Fletcher asked Seraph, who seemed to know the most in the group. But before the handsome boy could answer, there was a gasp from Atlas. The fat cadet was staring at the door. Fletcher turned and saw what had caused it. A dwarf had entered the room, and he had a demon with him. 19. The dwarf looked very much like Atoll had, with a dark red beard and a powerful stocky body. He glared at them from beneath his bushy eyebrows and then took a tray from a nervous servant's hands. He sat away from the group on another table, turning his back on them. Though Fletcher was sure that the dwarf was the source of everyone else's fascination, he was more interested in the demon that had trailed in behind him. At 3 feet high, the creature was shaped much like a young child, were it not for its squat profile and hefty arms and legs. Yet what was most fascinating was its colouring. The creature looked as if it was made from misshapen rock, the effect made more striking by a dusting of moss and lichen that grew on its surface. Its hands were like mittens, with a thick opposable thumb that could be used for grasping. With every movement it made, Fletcher could hear the dull rasp of stone against stone. As the commoner stared at it, the demon turned around and looked back through a pair of small black eyes that were set deep in its head.
A column! Those are difficult to capture. The servants said they grow over time, so you have to catch them young, Seraph whispered. I hope I get gifted one of them.
Not likely, Atlas said.
They must have given it to him as a favor to the Dwarven Council, a show of good faith as dwarves are incorporated into the army. I didn't realize they had been accepted into all branches of the military. God knows what they would ride if any joined the cavalry. Their little legs would barely be able to grip a horse's sides.
Atlas laughed at the thought. Fletcher ignored him, looking at the dwarf sitting hunched and alone. He stood up.
What are you doing?
Rory hissed, snatching at Fletcher's sleeve.
I'm going to introduce myself, Fletcher said.
Did you see the look he gave us? I think he wants to be left alone,
Genevieve stammered. Fletcher pulled out of Rory's grasp, ignoring them. He had recognized the look of resentment on the dwarf's face when he walked in. He himself had worn it many times before, back when he had been ostracized by the other village children in Pelt. As he approached the bench, the golem rumbled threateningly, its craggy face opening to reveal a toothless mouth. The dwarf turned at the noise, a look of apprehension on his face.
I'm Fletcher!
He held out his hand for the dwarf to shake.
Othello, what do you want?
The dwarf replied, ignoring it.
Nice to meet you. Why don't you sit with us? There's plenty of room,
Fletcher asked. The dwarf looked at the others, who were staring at them from the other table, their faces full of apprehension.
I'm fine here. Thank you for making the effort, but I know I'm not welcome,
the sullen dwarf muttered, turning back to his meal. Fletcher decided to make one last attempt.
Of course you are. You're going to be fighting the orcs just like the rest of us.
You don't understand. I'm nothing more than a symbolic gesture. Hominum's generals don't mean to let us join the military for real. They sent most of our recruits to the elven front to rot with the chaft. The king meant well by forcing them to let us join, but the generals are still the ones who decide what to do with us. How can we change their minds when they won't let us fight?
Othello murmured, so only Fletcher could hear.
Vokens has girls, commoners too. In fact, everyone you see here is a commoner. The nobles are arriving tomorrow,
Fletcher replied, his heart going out to the unhappy dwarf. He paused for a moment, then leaned closer to the dwarf and whispered.
They need adepts, no matter where they come from. There's even an elf. I don't think the Battle Mage Division is very picky, as long as you can fight.
The dwarf smiled at him sadly, then took Fletcher's hand and shook it.
I know about the elf. We had an interesting conversation when we were waiting to be gifted our demons. Anyway, I hope you're right. I'm sorry for my rudeness earlier. I must sound very jaded,
Othello said, picking up his tray.
Not to worry. I met another dwarf yesterday, and he felt much the same as you did. He gave me something,
Fletcher said, pulling the card he had been given from his pocket.
Put that away,
Othello hissed under his breath as soon as he saw it. Fletcher stuffed it back in his trousers. What was the big deal? They sat down at the table with the others, their conversation suddenly muffled by the dwarf's presence. Fletcher introduced them all.
Good morning,
Othello said awkwardly, nodding to everyone. They all nodded back in silence. After a few beats, Rory piped up. It seemed to Fletcher that he hated awkward silences,
I'll tell you what. I wish I could grow a moustache like that. Did you always have one?
Rory said, stroking his own bare face.
If you're asking if I was born with it. No,
Othello said, cracking a wry smile.
It's our belief that cutting our hair is a sin to the Creator. We are made just as he wished us to be. If he gave us hair, then we must keep it. Why don't you let your nails grow too, then? Sounds like madness to me,
Atlas said bluntly, pointing at Othello's stubby but neatly trimmed fingers.
Atlas, Genevieve scolded. That's okay. It's a fair question. We consider the grey part of the nail dead, and therefore no longer part of us. Of course, it is considered more of a tradition than a religious belief these days. Many dwarves trim their beards and hair. Some of the younger dwarves even dye it. This is quite common knowledge in Corsilum. Where do you hail from?
Othello asked in a measured voice.
I'm from a village to the west, close by the Vesanian Sea, Atlas retorted. Are you from Corsilum originally?
Othello paused, looking bemused. Seraph answered for him. The dwarves were here before the first man even set foot in this land. They cleared the forests, flattened the earth, diverted the rivers, even put up the great marker stones that map out Hominum's territory. Othello smiled, as if impressed by the young commoner's knowledge of his people.
Mankind moved here 2,000 years ago, when they made the long journey across the Akkad Desert,
Seraph continued, encouraged by the rapt attention of the others.
Corsilum was the dwarf capital, so we moved in with them, working and trading. But then a great sickness swept through the city, hitting the dwarves particularly hard. Soon after, our first king took power with help from what now are the noble families. They were a small group of summoners who controlled powerful demons, far stronger than the demons our modern-day summoners control. That is why every royal and noble-born is able to summon. They inherited their ancestors' abilities. It is also why we rebelled so often,
Othello said in a hushed tone.
Foolish though it was, with our population so low and no summoners in our ranks. We never recovered our numbers after the sickness, thanks to a law forced on us by your king's forefathers. We must live in the ghetto and may only have a certain number of children each year. We cannot even own our own land. The royal said we have brought it on ourselves after so many rebellions.
A somber mood settled over the others, but Fletcher felt angry, the same anger he had felt at Didrik's injustice.
This was inhumane.
The hypocrisy of the situation sickened him. So this was what Atoll had been talking about. Atlas opened his mouth to speak again, a look of disagreement on his face.
So, Seraph, you said you have done your research. Tell us a bit about what we should be expecting over the next few months,
Fletcher interjected, before Atlas could start an argument. Seraph leaned forward and beckoned everyone closer, smiling at the opportunity to show off what he had learned.
They are very fair here. Commissions are given based on merit, so the better you perform in the exams and challenges, the higher the officer's rank you are given when you graduate. The problem is that it is weighted against us commoners. The demons we get given are not particularly strong, whilst the demons the nobles receive are from their parents, who take more care to capture powerful ones for their children. Some are even fortunate enough to be given one of their parents' own demons, but that is rare. Fletcher's demon I'm not so sure about. I've never seen one of those before. But, Othello, your demon will be very powerful when it is full grown, from what I have heard of golems.
So, we're always going to only have our mites?
Genevieve asked, confused.
Not necessarily, Seraph answered. It's possible to capture another, more powerful demon in the ether and add it to your roster. I don't know much about how to do that,
and apparently it is harder and riskier to do it with a weak demon. I'm hoping for something other than a mite. They make great scouts and their pincers pack a nasty punch, but their mana levels are quite low, and physically they would be no match for even a juvenile canid.
I see, Genevieve said, looking slightly less proudly at Azura as she took off and buzzed around the room.
They all watched as she settled on the huge statue in the center of the hall, crawling onto the stone man's eye.
Who is that, anyway?
Fletcher asked the table.
I know,
Othello said, pointing at the plaque beneath the statue.
It is Ignatius, King Corwin's right-hand man, and the founder of the Volcans Academy, back when it was nothing more than a tent in a field. He died in the First Orc War a couple of thousand years ago, but he is credited with leading the suicidal charge that broke the Orc ranks and ultimately led to their defeat.
That's it,
Fletcher said under his breath, looking at his imp. It had crawled down his arm and was looking at the remains of the porridge in his bowl with relish.
What's it? Rory asked. Ignatius. That's what I will call my demon.
20. With breakfast over, the others decided to go back to their rooms for more sleep. But Fletcher was loath to sit in the cold. The conversation over breakfast made him realize how little he knew about this place. He was going to find Geoffrey. If Seraph knew so much about the Citadel from the servants, he was going to tap that source of information for all it was worth. He was in luck. Geoffrey was still polishing the atrium floor.
Can I trouble you to show me around again? There's not much point in cleaning that floor now. It's just going to get dirty again when the second years come down for breakfast,
Fletcher said to the tired-looking servant.
I'm only polishing it so that Mr. Mayweather doesn't yell at me. If I can say I was showing a novitiate round, then I'm off the hook. Let's just take it easy on the stairs this time,
Geoffrey said, grinning.
What would you like to see?
Everything,
Fletcher said. I've got all day.
Then so have I.
Geoffrey beamed.
Let's go to the summoning room first.
The room was on the same floor within the east wing. The large steel doors were difficult to open, the screech of rusted hinges echoing around the atrium. Geoffrey took a torch from a sconce outside and led him in, lighting their way with a flickering orange flame. The floor was sticky underfoot, which upon closer examination turned out to be made of heavy strips of leather. There was a large pentacle painted in the middle of the room, the epicenter of a spiral of gradually smaller stars. Each was surrounded by the same strange symbols that Fletcher had seen on the summoner's book. Perhaps these were the keys that James Baker had written about.
Why leather? Fletcher asked.
The pentacles and symbols need to be drawn on something organic. Otherwise, they don't work. We used to have wood, but it kept burning and needed to be replaced. The provost decided that leathers were a better idea. It's worked so far. They smoke and smolder a bit, and it smells something awful, but it's better than risking a fire every time someone's demon enters the ether.
I had no idea,
Fletcher said, examining a row of leather aprons that hung on hooks beside the door.
I don't know much else about this room. You're better off asking a second year, but I wouldn't bother. The competition for ranks is fierce, and they don't like to help first years in case you steal what would have been their promotion. I hate that way of thinking, but the provost says that it's brutally competitive on the front lines. So why shouldn't novices get a taste of that here?
Geoffrey lingered by the door, refusing to venture any deeper into the room.
Let's go. This place gives me the creeps, he muttered.
He led Fletcher out, and they trudged up to the second floor of the east wing.
This is the library.
Geoffrey pushed open the first door.
You'll forgive me if I don't go in. The dust, it's terrible for my asthma.
The room seemed as deep and long as the atrium was tall. row upon row of bookshelves ranged along the walls, full of tomes even thicker than the book that lay at the bottom of Fletcher's satchel upstairs. Long tables sat between each bookshelf, with unlit candles spaced at intervals along them.
"There are thousands of essays and theories written here by the summoners of old. Diaries, mostly, dating back over the last 1,000 years or so. This place doesn't get used much. There is so much work to do already, without the extra reading. But some do come here for tips and tricks, usually the commoners, who don't have the coin to spend in Corsulum on the weekends,"
Geoffrey said, leaning against the doorway.
"They need to catch up anyway. The nobles always know more than they do, growing up with it and all."
"Fascinating," Fletcher said, eyeing the piles of books.
"I'm surprised that this room is used so rarely. There must be a treasure trove of knowledge here."
Geoffrey shrugged and closed the door.
"I wouldn't know. But I think the teaching in the school has become far more practical, out of necessity. There is just no time for research and experimentation anymore. All they care about is getting you to the front lines as quickly as possible."
As they walked out, Fletcher saw a string of boys and girls walking through the hall.
"Those are the second years," Geoffrey said, nodding at them. "They had a hell of a time this year. The competition for ranks is fiercer than ever. Now that convicts are likely to be drafted into the army, dwarves too, they're going to need officers. And if the second years don't perform well, that is who they will be leading into battle. Or rotting away with on the elven front."
Fletcher wasn't sure what would be so bad about leading dwarves into battle. But he wasn't going to get into a debate with Geoffrey, not when he still had so much to learn. He stared at the second years as they descended the dark stairs, without their demons. Tiny spheres of light floated around their heads like fireflies, emitting an ethereal blue glow.
"What are those lights? And where are their demons?"
Fletcher exclaimed, as he and Geoffrey followed them down the steps. The second years ignored him, rubbing their eyes and murmuring amongst themselves.
"Demons aren't allowed out, other than in your quarters or during lessons. You'll be told about that once you first years have settled in. Although where the demons go when they aren't with their summoners, I haven't a clue. As for the lights, they're called weird lights. It's one of the first skills novitiates learn, I think. In a few days, you guys will be zipping those things all over the place."
"I can't wait,"
Fletcher said, eyeing the little blue lights as they floated aimlessly around the atrium. "No wonder there's only one candle in our rooms." Geoffrey dragged him away from the atrium and down some stairs beside the entrance to the summoning room.
"The castle is huge, but the rooms are mostly used as accommodation for the nobles, teachers, and servants. The rest are either empty or used as storage, except for a few lecture halls,"
Geoffrey said, as their footsteps echoed down the dark steps. When they reached the bottom of the stairs, the first thing Fletcher noticed was a chain of manacles that were embedded in the walls of a long, dank corridor that stretched into the darkness. As they walked down it, Fletcher could see dozens of cramped, windowless prison cells, barely a few feet wide.
"What is this place?"
Fletcher asked, horrified. The conditions for people kept imprisoned in this way would have been appalling.
"This part of the citadel was built in the first year of the war 8 years ago for deserters. We didn't know what to expect, so whenever troops were sent to the front lines, we made sure they would bed down here for the night beforehand. That way, they would know what awaited them if they ran away in cowardice. We only ever had a few dozen prisoners in the first 2 years, or so I'm told. Nowadays, deserters are just flogged when they are caught, and then sent back to the front lines."
Geoffrey ran his hand along the bars as he spoke. Fletcher shuddered and followed him down the long corridor. He was surprised when the claustrophobic tunnel opened out into an enormous room. It was shaped like the inside of a colosseum,
with concentric rings of stairs that also served as seats, encircling a sand-covered enclosure. Fletcher estimated it could easily fit an audience of 500.
"What the hell is this doing here?" Fletcher asked.
Surely there could be no explanation for a gladiatorial arena such as this in the basement of the Citadel.
"What do you think, boy?"
came a rasping voice from behind him.
"Executions. That's what it was for. To give the soldiers and novices heart whenever we captured an orc, so they could see that they die just like any other creature."
Fletcher and Jeffrey spun to see a near toothless man with graying hair leaning on a staff. He was missing his right foot and hand, which had been replaced by a thick peg and wickedly sharp hook. Stranger still, he wore the chainmail armor of the unmodernized army, resplendent in dark green and silver from one of the old noble houses.
"Of course, it was never used. Whoever heard of an orc being captured alive?"
He cackled to himself and held out his left hand, which Fletcher shook.
"We captured a few gremlins, but watching them cower and piss their loincloths wasn't very gratifying. They probably have more of a quarrel with the orcs than we do, what with them being enslaved and all,"
the man said, limping down to the arena with a lopsided gait.
"Well, come on. Let's see what you can do with that corpish. Long time since I've seen one of them,"
the man called, brandishing his staff and pointing it at Fletcher's sword.
"I may have lost my good hand in the war, but I can still teach you a thing or two with my left. Hell, I must be able to. That's my job, isn't it?"
"Who the hell is that?"
Fletcher whispered, wondering what kind of madman would choose to spend his free time down in the dungeons. Jeffrey leaned in and whispered back.
"That's Sir Calder. He's the weapons master."
Sir Calder scraped a line in the sand with his staff and beckoned Fletcher closer.
"Come on. I may be a cripple, but I've got things to do."
Fletcher jumped into the arena and advanced towards him, cautioning Ignatius to stay beside Jeffrey with the thought. Sir Calder winked at him and raised his hook in mock salute.
"I know officer material when I see it, but can you fight like one?"
"I don't want to hurt you, sir. This sword is sharp,"
Fletcher warned him, unbuckling it and holding it out for him to see. It was the first time he had really held his weapon in his hand. The sword was far heavier than he had expected.
"Aye, I may be old, but with age comes experience. This staff here is twice as dangerous a weapon in my one hand than that kopesh is in both of yours."
Fletcher doubted it. The man was as skinny as a rake and about as tall, too. He gave a half-hearted swipe at him, aiming so that he wouldn't hit anything. The man made no move to defend himself, allowing the sword to graze harmlessly in front of his chest.
"All right, boy. Enough playing,"
Sir Calder snapped. The staff came thrumming through the air at Fletcher's head and dealt him a stinging blow. Fletcher cried out and slapped his hand over his ear, feeling the blood as it ran in a hot trickle down his neck.
"Come on. That sword wouldn't even pierce this chain mail,"
the old man said with glee, prancing in front of Fletcher like a billy goat.
"I wasn't ready for that,"
Fletcher snarled, then stabbed at Sir Calder's stomach, two-handed. The staff came down like a hammer, knocking his sword so hard that it stabbed into the sand. Fletcher was rewarded with another swat to his cheek, leaving a wide welt.
"That's not going to look pretty in the morning,"
Sir Calder cackled, jabbing at Fletcher's stomach and causing him to stumble back.
"You see, Jeffrey, they carry around their swords as if they're just for show. Let me tell you, when an orc charges at you from the bushes, don't think a musket ball is going to stop it. It'll be using your rib as a toothpick
before it even realizes it's been shot.
Sekulda ranted, punctuating each word with a prod of his staff. Fletcher's patience had run out. He swung his kopesh in a wide arc, catching the staff in the curve and pushing it to the side. Then he charged in under Sekulda's guard, shoulder-barging the man to the ground, landing on top of him. Before a shout of triumph could leave his lips, Sekulda's knees scissored around his neck, choking off the words. His peg leg knocked against the back of Fletcher's head. Fletcher dropped his sword and tried to pry open Sekulda's thighs, but they were like twin bars of steel. The man tightened his hold until Fletcher's vision bruised. Then the world faded to black. 21. When consciousness returned, Fletcher could hear the sound of Ignatius hissing. He opened his eyes to find Jeffrey and Sekulda watching him from across the arena. Sekulda was swearing foully, and there was the stench of burning in the air.
"God-damned demons! They should all be shot! It's good, solid fighting that will kill orcs, not these abominations," he grumbled, fingering a blackened patch of cloth in the breast of his surcoat. Ignatius must have flamed at him when Fletcher fainted. Fletcher rubbed his bruised throat ruefully and sat up. What was it with people trying to strangle him? Even Ignatius liked to wrap himself around his neck.
"There's something you're forgetting," Fletcher croaked. "The orc shamans have twice the number of these abominations, as you call them. Do you think good, solid fighting will beat them too? Why do you even teach here if you hate them so much?"
Sekulda and Jeffrey crossed the arena towards him, pausing every few steps in case Ignatius attacked again. Fletcher calmed Ignatius with soothing thoughts and then picked up the kopesh, buckling it back onto his belt.
"I'm sorry, laddie. I was just blowing steam. The surcoat was my old uniform. It's all I have left of the old days,"
Sekulda said, kicking at the sand with his stump.
"Well, it is my fault, too. I should have told Ignatius that this was a play fight, though I think we stretched the definition of the word play this time around. I'm sorry about your uniform. Can I replace it?" Fletcher asked.
"No, I fought under the Raleighs," Sekulda said, as if that explained everything.
"The Raleighs?" Fletcher asked. "Are they a noble family?"
"Aye, that they were. Not any more, though," Sekulda muttered.
Fletcher could see pain in the man's eyes, but his curiosity got the better of him.
"Why? Did they fall out of favor with the king?" Fletcher asked.
He had never heard of that happening before, though Pelt was so far removed from the machinations of Hominum's upper class, it could be a regular occurrence, for all he knew.
"No, nothing like that, you idiot. I served under Lord Edmund Raleigh, a long time before the war. He was one of the nobles who owned estates on the southern frontier, so our lands were being constantly raided by orc marauders. In those days, the military was too focused on keeping the dwarves in check to send us any help. So as part of Raleigh's bodyguard, we had to deal with it on our own. Lord Raleigh was a good man and a close friend to the king, so don't you go thinking he wasn't,"
Sekulda ranted.
"I meant no disrespect," Fletcher said, trying to be polite. "But I don't understand how the Raleighs fell out of power."
"The orcs, boy. That's who are to blame. They came in the dead of night, sneaking by all the livestock and the grain and everything else that my lads were protecting. We thought that was what they wanted. So why protect anything else?"
he said bitterly, clenching his fists at the memory.
"They slaughtered everyone in the Raleigh family home. The women, the young children. When we got word of it, they were gone, taking the dead with them as trophies and tying them to the trees on the borders of their territory. Lord Raleigh put up a terrible fight.
His canid took three of the orcs out before they slit its belly open and left it to bleed to death. I'll put it out of its misery myself, poor thing. So don't be thinking I have something against summoners, either.
Sir Calder shuddered at the memory, then walked up the arena steps to an open door in the wall.
You're not a bad fighter, but you're going to need to learn how to fight against an orc. That shoulder barge wouldn't have any effect, and you'll be fighting against heavy clubs and axes, not precision weapons. Come see me again, and I'll show you how, he said from the doorway, then disappeared inside with a satisfied grunt.
Geoffrey walked him to the entrance and lifted the torch to Fletcher's face, so he could see better in the dim light. Ignatius crawled onto Fletcher's shoulder and purred at the sight of the flame.
He really did a number on you. That's swelling up something fierce, Geoffrey said. It doesn't hurt that much.
Fletcher touched the welt on his face and winced. They returned in silence to the atrium, pondering Sir Calder's story, as they made their way back up the tall staircase.
Tour's over,
Geoffrey groaned as they emerged into the atrium.
I need to get back to work now.
Did you know about Sir Calder and the Raleighs?
Fletcher asked Geoffrey as the servant began to clean the floors again.
I knew about the Raleighs, but I had no idea Sir Calder served under them. I do know the Raleigh incident was what set the war in motion. The king and his nobles began to expand Ominum's borders in retaliation, cutting down their trees and raising their villages year after year. It was only when the albino orc began uniting the tribes that it became a proper war, though,
Geoffrey replied, scrubbing at the floor.
I can't believe I hadn't heard of it before.
Fletcher scratched his head. It seemed that living so far north of Corsulum had limited his education on the politics of the wider world.
You wouldn't. It was kept very hush-hush. The king doesn't like the commoners to know that a noble line can be snuffed out, just like that. It's only because noble offspring go here that I know about it. Sir Calder never mentioned anything like that before,
Geoffrey replied.
He must have cared about that uniform very much,
Fletcher said, stroking Ignatius's head.
Speaking of which, I can't believe you haven't had your clothes cleaned yet. It was a little nauseating in the confines of the corridor downstairs, Fletcher. Go back to your quarters, and I'll send someone to collect your clothes and take you to the baths. Seriously.
22. The moon was full and bright in the cloudless sky. Fletcher shivered and pulled at his uniform's collar. It was the only clothing that hadn't been taken away for cleaning. Still, he had to wear something. It was freezing in the room, and the tattered blanket on his bed did little to keep him warm. He leaned out of the glassless window and into the cold night air, thinking on the day. The elf had remained in her room, which had suited Fletcher just fine. The rest of the group had been cheerful during lunch and dinner, eager for tomorrow and what wonders it would bring. Fletcher found that he enjoyed the company of the others, although the tension between Atlas and Othello left a strained undertone to the otherwise cheerful evening. He was particularly drawn to Seraph, whose clear charisma and knack for storytelling had everyone hanging on to his every word. Rory's happy-go-lucky attitude had also endeared him to Fletcher, and although her efforts at salvaging his uniform had been in vain, he had found Genevieve to be a kind person with a surprisingly dry sense of humor. It was strange to know that they would all be risking their lives in the hot jungles of the South in just a few years. Although Fletcher tried to avoid thinking about it, the others were eager for battle. Genevieve was the only one who did not openly flaunt her wish to fight, although she spoke of the orcs with a dark fury that belied tragic experience. Fletcher knew he should go to sleep, yet he felt too exhilarated to do so. Even the usually lazy Ignatius had caught his mood. playfully chasing his tail in the darkness of the room. Fletcher held out his candle for Ignatius to light, then went out into the common room. As he entered, he saw fading candlelight from the stairwell, with the sound of hasty footsteps echoing from below.
"Come on, Ignatius. Looks like we aren't the only ones who can't sleep," Fletcher said.
If it was going to be a restless night, he might as well have company. The corridors were eerie at night, the chill drafts of air whistling through the arrow slits that peppered the outside of the castle. Fletcher's candle flame flickered with each gust, until he had to cup it with one hand to keep it from going out.
"I could do with one of those flying lights right now. Don't you think, Ignatius?"
he whispered. The shadows shifted unnaturally as he moved down the corridor, the dark slits of every suit of armor staring at him as he walked past. It seemed strange that whoever was ahead was moving so quickly, their pace closer to a jog than a midnight stroll. Fletcher hurried to keep up, his curiosity getting the better of him. Even when he reached the atrium, all he saw was the dim light and a swish of cloth as a figure darted out through the main entrance. The courtyard was silent as a grave and twice as eerie when Fletcher set foot outside. But there was no sign of the mysterious person. He walked to the drawbridge and peered out at the road, looking for the candlelight. As he stared into the wavering gloom, he began to hear the steady clop of hoofbeats on the ground, coming towards the citadel. Fletcher darted into a small room built into the drawbridge's gatehouse, blowing out the candle and pressing himself against the cold stone wall. Whoever it was, Fletcher didn't want their first impression of him to be that of someone who liked to sneak around in the dead of night. He quelled Ignatius's excitement, impressing on him the need for silence with a stern thought. He remembered what happened the last time he had been in a cold stone room, hiding in the dark. At that memory, the imp responded with agreement and even a hint of what felt like regret. Fletcher smiled and scratched Ignatius's chin. The imp understood more than he thought. The chirr of spinning wheels and the crack of whips announced the arrival of carriages, rumbling as they crossed the old drawbridge. Fletcher peered through a crack in the stone of the room, hugging his arms to his chest for warmth. Was it the nobles? Perhaps one of the teachers was arriving early? There were two carriages, both ornately decorated with golden trimming and lit by crackling torches. Two men rode on top of each, wearing dark brass-buttoned suits and peaked caps that put Fletcher in mind of the Pinkertons' uniforms. All of them carried heavy blunderbusses in their hands, ready to blast buckshot into anyone who ambushed their convoy. Precious cargo, indeed. The doors opened and several figures got out, wearing perfectly tailored versions of the Vokan's uniform. In the dim glow of the torches, it was hard to see their faces, but the one closest stepped in clear view.
"Oh, dear," he said to the others in a posh, drawling voice. "I knew this place had gone to the dogs, but I didn't think it was going to be this bad."
"Did you see the state of it, Tarquin?"
said a girl from the shadows.
"It's a wonder we made it over the drawbridge."
Tarquin was a handsome boy with chiseled cheekbones and angelic blonde hair that fell in curls down to the nape of his neck. Yet his blue-grey eyes seemed to Fletcher as hard and cruel as any he had seen before.
"This is what happens when you let the riffraff in," Tarquin stated with a contemptuous sneer. "Standards are slipping. I'm sure when Father was here, this place was twice what it is now."
"Still,
at least the commoners can be given the commissions we don't want," the girl said, out of Fletcher's sight. "Yes, well, that is the silver lining," Tarquin said in a bored-sounding voice. "The commoners can have the criminals, and if, heaven forbid, they allow dwarves to serve as officers, then they can command the half-men too. Keep everyone in their proper place. That's the way to do it. Everyone in their rightful place."
A girl stepped out from the gloom and stood beside him, squinting at the tall citadel in front of them. She could have been Tarquin's twin, with razor-sharp cheekbones and cherubic hair, curled in delicate blonde rings.